The American dream is all about possibilities, the idea that anyone, in theory, has the chance to move from whatever humble beginning to become rich or influential or important in some way. That's upward mobility, the chance to start poor and end rich, or at least a lot happier. And there are lots of signs that upward mobility is a lot harder in our time. Our guest this hour focuses on one of the keys to moving up, higher education, and a host of issues there. Paul Tough is the author of The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. Paul Tough writes and speaks about education, inequality, and success. He writes for New York Times Magazine and contributes to public radio's This American Life and is the author of three previous books. Paul, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thank you. Great to be here.
It sounds like you traveled many miles for this book. What did you set out to do?
I did. This book took me 6 years to report and write. I went to 21 different states to do my reporting. And the goal was to try to understand the intersection in this country between these two great sort of American themes, higher education and social mobility. And in the past, I feel like the relationship between those two things was really clear, right? That higher education was the great engine of social mobility. It was the thing that could reliably help low-income students reach the middle class and help middle-class students reach affluence. But what inspired me to start this reporting was this sense that that engine had broken down and that there were all kinds of ways that higher education, especially for low-income students, was now more of an obstacle to their social mobility. It was the thing that was keeping them from their dreams. So I wanted to try to understand how and why that had happened, what it was like to be a young person who was in the middle of that process, and then what we might be able to do to change things.
And you begin with the vignette of Shannon, a high school senior in New York City. This is a story that gets us in tears in pretty short order. How hard did she work at school?
Harder than anyone I've ever met, I would say. So she went to a big, low-income public high school in New York City, in West Harlem. From the very first semester of freshman year, she was at the top of her class in her high school in the front hall. They posted these big boards that had everyone's name, and she was at the top of freshman year. She was still, when I met her in senior year, still at the top. She hadn't missed a single day of high school. But she wasn't one of these kids for whom school came especially easily. She would work tremendously hard, staying up till 2 and 3 in the morning to make sure all her homework was done perfectly. And she was just completely stressed out. But she had these goals, these dreams about where education could take her.
She wanted to get into Penn. Princeton was her backup, and then her backup was Davidson. And you're with her on the day that I didn't realize all Ivy League schools announced their offers at the same time, on the same day, March 30th, 5 p.m. And so there she was just waiting for something, realized, oh, I have to log on. So had to go through that whole rigmarole to find out that, no, she was not offered a slot at either Penn or Princeton. But the importance of that period in her life and how it shapes the rest of her life, this is where the title of the book really smacks us in the face. The years that matter most, really just a few years make all the difference.
Yeah, it is this fact that economists now point to, that these few years, it's more so than any time in American history and more so than any other nation in the world, because our system of higher education is so unequal and stratified, these years have now taken on this outsized importance in social mobility. And so if you are admitted to the kind of institution that Shannon was aspiring to, it really does erase so many of the disadvantages from your past. If you grow up in a low-income home like Shannon did, the economist Raj Chetty, who is at Harvard, he discovered that if two students go to any given institution, whether if one's high income and one's low income, after 4 years in that school, the disparities between them are almost completely erased. And as adults, they're going to make almost the same amount of money. The problem is that those students generally are not going to the same institutions, that the most highly selective institutions are admitting almost only rich kids, and that low-income students are much more likely to go to less selective, less well-funded institutions. So as a result, higher education tends to make these disparities that students come to college with worse rather than diminishing them.
All right. This is a continuing theme throughout the book and the study here, the idea that if you're super smart but not super rich, there's a good chance you're not going to get into the super rich school to hang out with the other super smart people. They got the money, you don't. More likely you're going to stay without the money. I'll get a lot more careful about how we describe that going forward. But you point out in the early part of the book that upward mobility did exist once. You know, Henry Ford grew up on a farm and all of that. What changed?
Well, I think there's sort of a couple of different stages. So, right, in the early years of this country, we were sort of founded on this idea of social mobility, and it was always a little bit of a myth, but in the past it was much less so. It was amazing to me, looking not just at Henry Ford, but at all of these sort of titans of industry in the 19th century, your Vanderbilts and your Rockefellers, how many of them grew up in poverty. And early political thinkers understood that this was this sort of central idea of the United States. Beginning sort of after World War II, what changed was that instead of being able to sort of lift yourself up through your grit and ingenuity and entrepreneurialism like some of those early industrialists did, instead the force that would guide people to better lives became higher education. I think the GI Bill had a lot to do with that. It really increased the number of students who were going to college, and a lot of us came to see, like, this is the means that students are able to achieve that. And then only in the last, I think, decade or two has that started to break down and have the system that after World War II was creating all of these pathways of opportunity through private colleges and public colleges for hardworking young kids from the working class or from low-income families to change their pathway in life. We have now changed the way that system works in ways that make it harder and harder for those kids to succeed.
Is it because it costs so much more? Is that the primary obstacle?
I think that's only part of it. I think in the public side of things, a big part of it is that we have just, as the public, we've stopped spending money on public higher education. So the GI Bill was probably the greatest flowering of this moment, where we believed as a country in the importance of the sort of collective good of public higher education. This idea that, you know, your children's education benefits me and my children's education benefits you. And we lost that, and we, as a result, stopped spending as much money on public higher education. That has meant that public college is more expensive for students, but also it's just less effective. It's less well-funded.
Much more to talk about with Paul Tough. His book is The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us, a study of upward mobility in America and the considerable obstacles to it at colleges in this day and time. You can join the conversation on The Exchange by phone and email. We'll come back and talk more with Paul Tough and The Years That Matter Most in a minute 20. You already raised the name Raj Chetty, Paul. He's a scholar of mobility, and he came up with a really innovative way to get a hold of a huge data set. What did he do?
So he is part of this movement in economics. He's an economist. He's part of this movement called Big Data, where these economists look for giant data sets that can help them understand sort of big trends in American life. So big data has changed the way we think about political campaigns, the way we think about baseball scouting. But he wanted to use it to try to understand social mobility. And that was hard to do in the United States because we don't have the same kind of data sets that other countries do. And the data that he wanted was tax records from the IRS, because that can really show over generations how individual families and their parents, an individual's parents and individual's children, how they their incomes change. But it was hard to get that IRS data. So he saw an ad in an economics journal asking for contractors to come and help them clean up their data. And he said, well, I'll do this for free if you give me access to the data. So after a few negotiations, the IRS finally agreed, sure, you can take a look at this data. And that has opened all of these doors that were previously closed to help us understand through his work how social mobility really works and how institutions of higher education affect it. And what he found is that college, where you go to college, whether you go to college, is this hinge, is the thing that makes the biggest difference in how mobility works in an individual's life and in the country as a whole.
So in essence, if you go to a top college, you end up making a lot of money. How small an island is that, though?
Well, it's different at different levels. I mean, so certainly the most highly selective institutions are the ones that make the biggest difference. So One stat that's in his data is that if you go to what he calls an Ivy Plus college, the Ivy League and a few other very selective institutions, in early adulthood, you have a 1 in 5 chance of not only being wealthy, but being in the top 1% in early adulthood. And at one level down, the sort of super selective institutions that aren't quite in the Ivy League, the chance is 1 in 11. So being in that top tier really does matter. But at the same time, not all of us want to be in the top 1%. And so going to college, going to any college makes a huge difference. This phenomenon that economists call the college wage premium, which is just the amount, the extra amount that you make if you have a BA as opposed to a high school degree, that is higher than it has ever been in American history. And that is true no matter what kind of institution you go to. So a college degree is valuable in the economy no matter where you go, but it is especially valuable if you go to one of these super selective institutions.
So as you pointed out, the fact is that most of the people who attend these Ivy Plus schools, for example, are already well-to-do. I mean, is it a smaller percentage now of students in lower economic quintiles who get into these schools?
It's not clear how that has changed over time. I mean, certainly, you know, if you looked at these Ivy League schools 100 years ago, it wasn't like there were lots of poor and working class kids. They sort of have always been institutions of great. That mostly educates students from affluent families. I think what's different now is that the public perception of how those institutions work has changed, and those institutions have worked to change that public perception. They talk a lot about merit and about diversity and about this idea that they're educating a broad swath of the American student population. But in reality, when you look at the numbers, and Raj Chetty's data really makes it a lot easier to do that than it was in the past, you can see that very little has changed.
So one of the bigger differences that turn up in this book is that what elite schools spend on their students. How big an investment is that per student?
Yeah, there is this huge disparity, and this is another economist from Stanford, a woman named Stanford named Carolyn Hawksby. She did this study that again showed this real sort of stratification of the higher education system, where not only were those most selective institutions creating more value added in the way that economists measure value, what your income is as an adult, but also they were just spending more on their students. So the most selective institutions are spending $150,000, $200,000 per student. And that was some of the most surprising data in the book for me, because I feel like we are very focused, as we should be, on the high tuition costs at those institutions. But it was shocking to me that even at those institutions, despite those high costs, the colleges are actually losing money on each student that they educate. They're investing more in their education than they're bringing in. And that most of the students that they are giving that additional benefit to are wealthy already. So they're investing all of this money into educating students who already have these advantages.
And here comes the why. Why?
Yes. Why? So why are they investing so much?
Yes.
I mean, so
they're losing money on the students.
Right. They work on what this economist, Carolyn Hawksby, calls the dynasty model, which is that they depend not on tuition to keep themselves afloat. They depend on alumni donations, right? And so it is a good investment. It just takes a long time to pay off. You pay for the student's education now. But there are all sorts of examples in the book of wealthy alumni of these highly selective colleges giving not just the equivalent of their tuition back when they are, you know, rich hedge fund managers, but giving millions and tens of millions and sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars to these colleges. So that is why that's why they do it. They see it as this investment that might take a long time to pay off, but so far it is working tremendously well for those institutions.
Paul Tough, the journalist, is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Years That Matter Most: How College Makes or Breaks Us. So for example, giving back more than just the tuition that you spent. Harvard, as you point out in the book, put on a 5-year campaign to raise $6.5 billion, with a B, dollars. What happened?
So, yes, this was the biggest fundraising drive that any college had ever undertaken. When they said they were going to try and raise $6.5 billion, people thought they were crazy, and they gave themselves 5 years to do it. And in fact, they made the $6.5 billion in 2 years. And by the time they got to the end of those 5 years, they were at $9.6 billion. So even when they set these crazy, unaudacious goals, wealthy Americans are so eager to give money to these institutions that are already educating a lot of wealthy Americans and already have a ton of money that they are able to bring in more than they want. And it's one of the craziest inequities in the system that wealthy Americans are often giving these tax-deductible contributions, not to the institutions that actually do the most to promote equity, that actually educate a lot of low-income students and actually have budget problems, but instead they're giving their donations to the institutions that already have the money and that are mostly educating high-income students.
As you point out, the elite, the Ivy Plus schools are playing a long game here, the idea that they're actually losing money on a day-to-day basis on the cost of education, but the idea being that they'll get it back in things like that campaign at Harvard. But what's the eventual result here? Because it seems like it's an ongoing process where you continue to put a lot of money into people's educations and they feel good about their education and give you a lot of money later on. But to what end?
Well, yes, that's a great question. So, I mean, certainly they're providing a great education, and those students are benefiting from it. But I think that these institutions like Harvard also see themselves or want to see themselves as having a public mission. I mean, these are nonprofit organizations, despite their vast wealth. And I think in their better moments, these institutions feel like part of their mission is educating, giving this advantage to students who need it. I mean, kids like Shannon, right? When a young person like Shannon, the young woman who I was there sitting on the bench with in the first chapter of the book as she was waiting to hear from the colleges she'd apply to, when they do go to these highly selective institutions, it makes a huge change in their lives. And I do feel like these institutions on one level want to be that engine of social mobility again. But for a variety of reasons, some of which I understand and some of which I don't, they are not doing enough of it. And they're admitting very few of those students. They often spend a lot of time talking about those students and publicizing those few low-income and first-generation students who they do admit, but they are not doing much to change their admission strategy as a whole.
I don't want to leave people hanging in case they got interested in the story of Shannon. I know I did from reading that portion of the book, but she did end up at Stanford. Found out the next day. Stanford waits a day behind the Ivy Plus schools. Isn't that nice of them? But yeah. In essence, are people like Shannon really trying to thread a needle?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the thing that was so interesting to me and about her experience and the way that I went through it with her is, yes, there is a happy ending to her story, but there was something about the experience of putting all of her faith into these two institutions and going through the process, fortunately for me, with me sitting there next to her, talking to her as it happened, of not getting into those institutions and then getting into this other institution that's actually more selective. It's very rare to not get into Penn, but to get into Stanford. But she was very grateful and excited, and she's doing great at Stanford now. There was something about that process that sort of shook up this intense faith that she had built up in the system more than anyone else, I think, that I wrote about. She was a true believer in the idea of meritocracy and social mobility. She really believed that if she worked hard, she could she would benefit in the system, and she did, and she is. The way that it happened for her made her realize how fluky it is. You know, how it is not really about merit. It is really about luck, and whether that's the luck of how much money your parents are and what zip code you were born into, or it's the luck of what a particular admissions officer sees in your college application on a certain day. Any social mobility system that is based on luck is hard to really put a lot of our faith into. And I think that's what changed for Shannon that week.
Social mobility is the ultimate goal of exploration in Paul Tough's book, The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. It really does delineate the differences between what you get if you go to an elite Ivy Plus kind of school and what the rest of us get. You can join the conversation on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Email from Debbie in Talent wants to know, Paul, where you went to school.
So I had a bit of a checkered college career. I went to Columbia University, and I dropped out, and then I went to McGill University in Montreal. I'm from Canada, so that was a cheaper option for me. And then I dropped out of there, and I didn't complete my BA. I started my journalism career. This was in the late 1980s. I started my journalism career with an internship at Harper's Magazine. Thought maybe I would go back to college, but never ended up doing it. So I am a guy who writes about college without a BA myself.
Wow. Congratulations on that. You've made the most of it. Let's take another phone call here from Ryan in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Paul Tough.
Well, good morning, Paul. Good morning, Jeffrey.
Hi.
What a pleasure to chat with you. I recently retired from an equity and access program in Oregon. I'm trying to get rural, underrepresented, mostly Latino, Native American, and first-gen kids to consider an academic future of some kind. And looking at the barriers, both in terms of their preparation and an academic vision, but also a huge issue, which is the dropout rate. Massive amounts of effort and energy are spent in trying to get young people from diverse communities to come to college. They show up there and they look around and go, this isn't me. And it kind of gets at the diversity question of, if diverse students don't find a home in college, what's the argument then the colleges should be making for changing the culture of their college? Anyway, thank you.
That's a great question. Thank you for the work, and thanks for that question. So I think it's hard for colleges to sort of change their way of thinking and to invest in the idea that it's part of their job to help their students succeed and to help their students feel this sense of belonging. I think a lot of institutions of higher education operate on this kind of sink or swim mentality, where part of the point of higher education is we're just supposed to sit back and see who can make it and who can't, and you know, separate the wheat from the chaff. And in reality, what institutions are finding is that if they do that, a lot of their students don't succeed. And the students who are least likely to succeed are the students who need this college education the most. It's low-income students, students of color, first-generation students. Colleges, what I saw in my reporting is that colleges and universities are starting to change their tune, and they're starting to realize that sink or swim mentality is not one that's going to serve them or their students over the long term. I reported a lot at the University of Texas in Austin, a flagship public institution that over the last decade or so has put a lot of energy and time and money into improving its graduation rate. And the way that the administrator I followed did that was focusing especially on the groups that had the lowest graduation rate, first-generation students, students of color, and low-income students. And the interventions that they introduced were not that unusual. They were sort of common sense. It was just about trying to make students feel a sense of belonging, giving them access to better advising and counseling when they needed it, putting them into communities, giving them internships that made them feel connected to the university. And there's a lot of psychological research that finds that a lot of what is happening for students in that first semester and first year of college is anxiety about this idea of belonging, that a lot of students don't feel like they belong, and they get a lot of messages from their institution that they don't belong. And when universities can shift that message, and not just through, you know, a couple of bumper stickers, but through an ongoing process of reinforcement, send students the message, you belong here, you can succeed here, that makes a huge difference. And so the University of Texas in just a few years improved their graduation rate, their four-year graduation rate, by 20 points. And I think that any institution can do that. It is mostly just a question of deciding this is a goal for that university.
The mix of the student body comes up for scrutiny in your book, and I have seen in the past where educators point out that all students do better with a mix of high and low academic achievers together. They were once scattered among all kinds of institutions. What's the distribution now of the smartest kids, the kids with the greatest academic achievements?
Well, so it depends how you measure smartness, but if you measure it by standardized test scores, as some people do, there's been an additional sort of stratification happening in institutions. So this economist, Carolyn Hoxie, sort of tracked over many decades, high-scoring students changed their way of making choices about where they were going to college. In the past, they would be more likely to stay somewhere pretty close to home, to go to a good public institution in their state. And now, if you are a super high-scoring student, you always, almost always, try to go to the institution that has the highest incoming SAT and ACT scores. So there's been this clustering effect where high-scoring students will only go to school with other high-scoring students, and universities recognize this, and so they try to admit more and more high-scoring students, and that has only exacerbated the inequities that already existed in higher education.
So all the higher score, higher income people, it sounds like, all cluster at the top now.
Yeah, exactly. And there are all sorts of pressures that, that make it, that incline universities to keep this system going, including U.S. News and World Report, which gives, which families take very seriously when they're deciding where to apply, and which gives universities extra points for their incoming SAT score. So if you want to stop paying so much attention to the SAT, which is an important part of creating a more diverse student body, it's really hard to do that because there's a good chance that you're going to fall on those U.S. News rankings, and that can really hurt your bottom line.
Ah, okay, so everything gets shoved upward. We're talking about college and how big a factor it is in success, certainly economically later in life, and how it translates to upward mobility. Less than it used to, it turns out, as Paul Tough found out in 6 years of reporting for the book called The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. We have a lot more to talk about, and you can join the conversation by phone and email, 800-838-3760. For the phone calls, emails go to jx@jeffnet.com. We'll come back and talk more to Paul Tough about the years that matter most when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. You mentioned Carolyn Hoxby a couple of times, an economist who looked at the distributions of money and test scores and things like that, but she also addressed the issue as well. Talk about, if you would, the Expanding College Opportunities Project.
Yeah, this was a famous experiment that she and another economist named Sarah Turner from the University of Virginia undertook about a decade ago, where after having studied the reality of this sort of stratification of students in higher education, specifically the fact that so few low-income students were going to highly selective institutions, they decided to try to change this. And their theory was that if a big part of the problem was that students, low-income students, were not applying to the kind of colleges, high-achieving low-income students were not applying to the kind of colleges that they could get into, and if they did get into, they weren't going. They were instead choosing to stay close to home, to go to a community college or a local public university. And so their theory was that if they could send targeted information packets to students who fit in this category of high-achieving low-income students, they could actually change that. They could give them the information they needed to make the choice to go to a more selective institution. And in their rather large experiment that they did about a decade ago, they found some significant effects. They found that for not much money, students were making very different decisions. More recently, I report, and other people have reported, that when the College Board, the institution that runs the SAT, tried to replicate this with tens of thousands of students over more than 5 years, it did not have the same effects. And so the way that the College Board shared that information made it very difficult for the academic community to have a full understanding of what went wrong. And so there's still questions about whether the problem was with the replication or the problem was with the original theory. But there are indications now that that change alone, simply giving more information to low-income students, isn't enough. And to me, it's because my guess is that that has to do with the fact that, you know, the institutions themselves, not the students, are where the real problem is. It's the choices the institutions are making rather than the choices that the students are making that are keeping things so unequal.
Either for Expanding College Opportunities or the College Board replication of that, how explicit was the information that, you know, you'll make a whole lot more money if you go to a place like this?
It was pretty explicit. Yeah, it talked about, a lot of what they would do is say, well, with your test scores and your grades, you can get into really selective institutions. There's going to be a big payoff for you if you go to those institutions. But also the case they were making, which does make a lot of sense, is that if you are a low-income student and you are admitted to one of the very most exclusive institutions, you might actually end up paying less than you would at a less selective institution closer to home. So they were trying to make that case that you might think that these institutions are out of your reach because their list price tuitions are so expensive, but because they have so much money, they can be more generous with financial aid, and so your costs could go down.
There's another story in this portion of the book about a particular student, Kim, from Appalachia, who ended up going to Clemson University, but rather roundabout route. But she ended up pulling away from family and poverty, and did a lot of good. But she had to really work at it, didn't she?
She did. Yeah, her story was fascinating to me, and I originally saw her as being sort of one of these typical students who Carolyn Hoxby and Sarah Turner were targeting. Because a lot of their high achieving, low income students who aren't making those choices are like Kim, white rural students. And Kim, in some ways, she did sort of follow that path. She did not get great advice in high school. She maybe could have used a good information packet. She did choose a less selective institution than ones that she might have been able to get into. But once she got through that process, it was also very clear to me that there were all kinds of other obstacles in her way, and a lot of them were simply about money. You know, her family didn't have any money. Her mom had a lot of credit problems, and so she couldn't get what's called a parent plus loan, sort of a relatively high interest loan that parents can take out to help their kids pay for college. And so Kim, though she finally got into this good university, Clemson, was having a lot of trouble paying for it and couldn't go at first. And so I describe in the book the way that she bounced back from that setback after a couple of weeks of sitting on the couch, feeling sorry for herself and watching TV. But she's an example, I think, both of the obstacles that families and institutions put in the way of some students who aspire to higher education, but also the way that some of those students can overcome those obstacles. We make it harder than we need to, but there are a lot of kids like her who overcome those obstacles anyway.
The details make all the difference. You know, her stepfather would walk through the door and say, which season of Grey's Anatomy are you on now? And it's 4 yesterday, 7 today, that kind of thing. But Kim pulled it together and established residency in South Carolina so she could go to Clemson for a lot cheaper. So she really used your smarts to help herself out.
She did. She figured out, like, here's where I gotta get a place in South Carolina. I gotta get a job, and then I can just defer one semester and then start my classes. It was incredible to watch her do it, and she pulled it off. She's a scientist now. She's a senior. She's going to graduate and have a great career, I'm sure. But happy though her story is in many ways, it also to me is a frustrating one because you should not have to do the kind of incredible gymnastics that Kim did in order to get into college. You shouldn't have to jump through all of these hoops. You shouldn't have to get around all of these obstacles. It should be much more straightforward for a student like Kim to succeed.
Indeed. We have an email here from Chris, no town given. Chris writes, I was a professional dancer back in the 80s. I observed the same situation. I started dancing when I was 19 and quickly realized my skill level was way behind. The best dancers started dance when they were 5 years old. I worked hard and I became a professional age 22. But still, the best dancers were from rich families who could afford to send their kids to dance class at age 5. And these rich kids got most of the jobs. Also, I feel the National Endowment for the Arts funds orchestras and ballet companies that take a lot of money and hire rich kids because they are the ones with the training. So writes Chris, no town given.
Fascinating, yeah. I mean, so I don't know much about the dance world, but I believe the situation that he's describing. The thing that connects to for me is the way that the kind of interests, the kind of extracurricular activities that young people are doing, especially those from affluent communities in elementary school and middle school and high school, those have also become really important in college admissions. There's a book that I read about called Pedigree by a remarkable sociologist named Lauren Rivera, and she looks at the way that extracurriculars and the kind of sports that young people do not only pays off in terms of where you go to college, it also pays off in terms of the kind of jobs that you get, the way that, that especially, you know, sort of elite firms like law firms and investment banks hire out of college. They care a lot if you do sports like squash or golf or tennis, the kind of things that don't really pay off in life. There's not very few of us are able to pursue careers in those kinds of sports, but a lot of students use those sports, which are mostly played by wealthy Americans, a lot of students use those sports to get into these affluent colleges. So it's one more advantage that rich kids tend to have.
Let's talk about the advantages then conferred by the Ivy Plus schools. I mean, a better education, certainly. I mean, given the amount of money that the places are sinking into the students, as you mentioned, they're spending so much on the uneducating the students, they're actually losing money in the process. But how much of this is the quality of the education versus the quality of the credential? I mean, to follow up Chris's line a little further, I mean, is it because you got a good education, or is it because you got a good education from Harvard University, for example?
Yeah, I feel like that's kind of this unanswerable question, right? Like, it's very, very hard to sort of pick apart using tools of analysis to pick apart what the value is in a higher education. And certainly, it's lots of different things. I mean, whether you're going to Harvard or community college or somewhere in between, it's partly the stuff you learn, the knowledge that you gain, but it's certainly also the skills that you get, the ability to, you know, schedule your time, write an essay, make an argument, negotiate with people, get along with, you know, dorm mates. And then I think also, especially at the most exclusive institutions, it's who you know. It's the connections that you make. And so, but I guess my conclusion is, given that we can't really pick that apart, what's important is that it is valuable, right? And rather than saying, like, well, who's learning what, I think it's important to understand that part of a college education is the stuff that you can't really quantify. It is the way that students mature. It is the connections they make, the things they learn about themselves. And I think that's okay.
We get into the subject of credentialing. I've run into this before, where people are saying that part of what goes on now with the requirement that people have at least a bachelor's degree is less about any particular skills they might have than just about the fact that this is where we're going to set our bottom line. You have to have at least a bachelor's to get this job. So, I mean, are people going to college who in previous years wouldn't have needed to go to college? Just to be able to rise up to that level of being in the pack we're considering?
Yes, I think to a certain degree that is absolutely true. I think there are a lot of people who talk about that phenomenon and use it as sort of a skepticism about the value of a college degree. I mean, I think there is that's part of it, but I think there is also the fact that these jobs are changing. So one of the ones that people talk about when they say this didn't used to be a college degree where you needed a job where you needed a BA, and now it is being an executive assistant, meaning, you know, being the sort of right-hand person to some kind of executive in a corporation.
We used to call them secretaries.
Exactly. So, and you know, 50 years ago, being a secretary involved certain skills that you did not need to go to college to get, right? But now, being an executive assistant involves many more technical skills, right? The ability to use lots of different computer skills, but also the ability to like interact with people and schedule things and sort of organize corporate life in a way that does require a lot more skills, a lot more different types of talents than it used to. And so, the idea that a job would change the kind of requirements that go into it is not crazy to me. Like, that kind of is how jobs have changed over the years. I wrote a little bit about this moment in American history about 100 years ago called the high school movement when, in 1910, only about 10% of young Americans were graduating from high school. And then the technology changed, and suddenly we had these new technologies in offices, in factories, even on farms that required more than a sixth grade education to operate. And so communities decided we need to build high schools, and we need to make them free and public in our communities. And within 3 decades, suddenly the percentage of young people who are graduating from high school went from 10% to 50%. And so to my mind, we're in another moment like that now, where there are all these new technologies and signals from the labor marketplace saying, our kids need more education in order to get the jobs that use these technologies. But now I feel like we are resisting those signs in a way that we didn't 100 years ago. We're saying like, well, do you really need these skills? Yeah, you really do need these skills. Whether, you know, what kind of degree you need, what kind of institution you need it from, those are all negotiable. But the big picture signals from the economy is that you need more skills, more credentials, more training, and we are not responding to those signals by providing a free public education to young people to let them get it.
Ken in Ashland emails with a $640,000 question, which is, I know several people who have incredibly high debt after attending high-level schools. Is a crushing debt worth the degree? That again from Ken in Ashland.
And the answer is it depends. So the question of student debt, I think, is a real one and a serious one. When I look at the national data on debt, here's what I see, that most students who have debt don't have a ton of debt. They have a lot sometimes. I think the average is about $20,000 after you graduate with a BA. But $20,000 in student debt, if you end up with a BA, is actually pretty manageable. You know, it means you're paying maybe $200 a month, but you have a BA, so you're more likely to be earning a decent living. Now, whether we should be doing more to make it, you know, to reduce those costs and reduce those loans is a good argument. But the people who have huge, crushing debt, $50,000, $100,000, those are either well-off students who have made some good decisions and invested in, you know, a law degree or something that is going to pay off for them, or it is low-income students who have made some unfortunate decisions and spent a ton of money, often at for-profit colleges, on a degree that will not pay off for them. So the University of Southern California offers a degree in social work that is mostly online and that the average graduate has $110,000 in debt. That's not a good degree. That's not a good deal, but it doesn't mean that debt is always a bad thing.
Just a quick question here before we have to go, Paul. Are you confident that enough people are aware of the problem, that it's being addressed?
I hope so. I mean, that's kind of why I wrote The Years That Matter Most. You know, I want more people to be talking about this. I don't think that the changes are going to come through a few politicians making different decisions. I think it's got to be all of us pulling together and changing the conversation about how higher education and social mobility intersect. So I hope people read the book and make their own conclusions about how we can do that.
The book is called The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. Paul Tough wrote it and joined us. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
All right, take care. That'll do it for today's exchange. We're online at jeffexchange.org. Our producers, John Baxter and Angela Decker. Randy Babbitt at the controls. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.